Welcome to the Too Many Notebooks podcast. I'm Ben Mullins, and we're going to have another interesting conversation with another everyday interesting person. Today, I have Mr. Alan Gallant with me. Alan, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure, Ben.
Awesome. Well, would you give us a little bit of history about yourself? What do you do? Where are you from?
Sure. I was born and raised in the Bangor, Maine area. I was born in 1960, so I'm getting up there towards AARP status for sure. But basically, I spent a great deal of my youth kicking around and discovering theater and doing a bunch of that. And then in 1999, I decided to go back to school and get an undergraduate degree at the University of Maine. And then about a year after I matriculated that, I decided I wanted a grad degree. So I came to Florida, and the reasons were twofold. One was to get out of the ridiculous cold winters. By this time, I'm 43 years old, and I'm sick and tired of the ridiculous cold winters. It's very beautiful up in Maine during the spring, summer, and fall, but that's only about 4 months of the year. So the rest of the time is kind of cold. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not much. So I came to Florida to get a graduate degree in theater, acting, to hone my craft a little bit more. I'd kind of hit a ceiling, if you will. And it's interesting where life takes you from that. I defended my thesis in 2006 and immediately got work as a drama teacher at Windermere Prep, which is a private school here in Windermere, and did that for 2 years. In the meantime, I had established a relationship with Seminole State College, where you and I met, and you just successfully completed my course in communication. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And so I had an ongoing relationship with them. So after I spent 2 years teaching toddlers and middle schoolers, I decided I'll go back there. And in the meantime, I also started reconnecting in the professional theater and worked for a little while as an actor, and then kind of got into my original connection to theater, which was technical work, set building, lights, sound, all that sort of thing. And okay. I'm working at a theater in Winter Park right now.
Awesome. How did you get into acting? I think that acting, typically you ask, elementary, even into middle school age kids, and they're, what do you want to do? Oh, I want to be an actor.
Yeah, that's very true. We call them
show. How did you get into that?
Well, I wasn't a showbiz kid like those that you described, but I was definitely sort of forming an idea of being a performer even that far back.
Okay.
The problem was there was no real institutional theater study at the schools that I went to. I actually was born in Bangor, which is a small city, which has more sophisticated educational opportunities for kids and did have theater programs in some of their schools. But I grew up in a small town right outside of there called Glenburn, Maine. It was only 1,500 people when I was a kid, and we had a small elementary school, and they didn't really have a lot of that sort of thing going on there. Our arts program was relegated to, arts and crafts kind of stuff. And we didn't have performing arts. So I didn't have that outlet directly. But here's the deal. Between the ages of about 8 and 10, I started to become really interested in the, let us say, the dramatic aspect of the behavior of actors, how they behaved in roles and so on. And I was able to, tell the difference between a character and the actor or actress who played that character at a fairly early age. So that was something else that was probably a hint that this was a direction I was probably going to end up going. So as I've used as an example in our class together, I became very interested in a show called Dark Shadows, which was a spooky daytime soap opera that was on in the late 1960s, and became very fascinated with that, a very overly dramatic, sort of melodramatic style of acting. And it fired my imagination. And a bunch of us of the same age in my class, boys mostly, but a few girls, were all really interested in the show. So we would get together and we would sort of play act scenes. And at the time, I didn't realize what we were doing was improvisational scene work. You don't even know what's the word improvisation when you're eight, nine, 10 years old. You don't know that word, but that's what we were doing. So that was some of my earliest experience with that in terms of getting positive feedback, having a good time doing it, that sort of thing. And there were various projects in history class and or social studies class and that gave myself and a few of my friends an outlet to perform, pretend to be certain types of characters out of history, that sort of thing. But so there was a little bit of that going on, but it was very fractious, and there was no drama teacher, so to speak. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, that's awesome. I think that some of the most iconic actors and movie stars, they start kind of at a young age without realizing it. I was listening to interviews with like Ryan Reynolds, and he was just being funny.
He was being a class clown kind of guy.
Right. And I think that could be important in an acting career, is being able to, I guess, hone your inner child a little bit.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Be able to pretend.
It's really critical that at that age that you have certain mentors or teachers or older siblings or whatever that don't discourage you, you know, that actually support. If they can't support you, at least they don't discourage you.
Right. And that's pretty proven, I think, as well. Even outside of acting, take like the Beatles or even AC/DC. You listen to interviews with them, and they say, "Well, we always had a guitar, we had a piano around the house, and we just banged around on it. And our siblings were always, oh, well, play this, try this, you know, try that."
Right. There was a culture of like in the case of AC/DC, there's a culture of music in the household from an early age, which is, you know, accepting of all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, there was really no culture of performance. My mother had done a few things in high school and so on, and she was even out of high school on an amateur level. So she was appreciative of it, and she certainly didn't discourage me from it as time went on. She mm-hmm. encouraged me more or less. My dad didn't really have any connection to it at all, but at the same time, he also encouraged me by not like saying, you know, go out and become a doctor or a lawyer instead, you know, that sort of thing, which can happen to people. A lot of times that's a challenge, because of course your parents don't want you in a business that's let's say it's fraught with economic stumbling blocks, like entertainment can be for the average actor or, you know, whatever participant in that. So I was never really discouraged from that, which I thought was amazing. But I was also, I think my parents knew that at an early age I was a little different than my two siblings. And I had a different constitution. I had sensitivity that came right to the surface. It's not that my other family members didn't have that sensitivity. It was just that my other family members were a little bit more taciturn, like, you know, typical Yankee New Englander type stuff going on. They were, you know, expressive within the family, but they weren't overly outgoing. And I tended to be more sensitive. I mean, as a kid, I was a little bit, you know, I'd cry at the drop of a hat. Sad happened, you know, I would be more excited about certain things than other people in my family. And so they understood that about me, I think, even before I understood it about myself. So, but this continued on, this fractious sort of exposure to performing arts continued on through grade school and into high school. And it wasn't until I was a senior in high school that I actually acted in a play. And and they did not. And I went to another situation where the high school was in a rural area. We only had 400 students, I think, in the entire school. And the graduating class, my graduating class was somewhere in the 60s. You know, it was not very big at all. Of course, down here in Florida, especially in the greater Orlando area, you have high schools that start at 1500 and go up. So it's a very, very different world. You end up knowing everybody, for better or worse, in a small school like that.
It's funny. I grew up in a small town with barely 1,000 people, and knew everyone that I went to school with. I mean,
that's awesome. You had a similar experience to me. Yeah.
Yep. And in my grade, and then most of my friends were the grade above me. And they're still my friends today.
Yeah.
And I think that all of my friends are older than me. Everyone.
I went through a phase like that. I had a lot of mentors that were 10 years, 20 years older than me, especially when I was first in the theater. Mm-hmm. And I kind of preferred that, actually, after a while. I just got, you know, it seemed to fit me better. And people got me were older. They were more observant about where I was coming from. Mm-hmm. In terms of that sort of thing. But these go ahead.
Oh, I feel like that's kind of where I'm at now mm-hmm. with especially like my flying and just the people that I hang around are a lot older than me. I tend to almost hang around with my friends' parents just as much as I hang around with my friends.
Yeah, it can be beneficial, I think.
I mean, they're older and a lot of them have some pretty good things to say, some life experience and wisdom that they've went through, and they'll I've got a couple of them that'll sit me down and be like, hey, you can't do this shit anymore,
right,
like this
right.
or that, you know.
Have experience, they know. It's right, like, I did this and I had to stop. Yeah, it's true. That of course happened to me, as you know, but your listeners won't know until I tell them now, is I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I had several mentors that helped me on that pathway as well. Mm-hmm. That was a kind of an important thing to have more experienced people involved in, especially initially. So, but in all aspects of my life, I've run into that situation. I've always been a good student of life. I've learned. I've never begrudged anybody else's experience. I've tried to profit by it.
That's important. I quoted Ferris Bueller in my last speech that I gave for the class, and I said, he has that famous quote: "Life moves pretty fast sometimes. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it."
Yes.
And that's pretty accurate. I mean, it's relatable, because a lot of people just kind of float through. But sometimes you gotta get out and live a little bit.
Great, I agree. It's great to have plans. I think plans really structure our lives and put us in the right direction. But also those plans should be viewed as not something rigid that's going to absolutely have to happen in our lives, but as a way of preparation for what life throws our way. Because I ended up in places I never dreamed I'd be in life. And you know, mostly positive, and some of that had to do with the plans of, you know, going back to school and honing my craft and doing this and doing that, and some of them just had to do with, okay, I was in the right place at the right time and I was ready to accept this offer. And that's one of the great lessons of acting, actually, is to accept the offer that you're given. Either the author is giving you this offer by placing you in the scene as this character and with these actors, and you listening, and you have an exchange of energy, and you accept the offer of the other characters, and you do with it what your character would do with it. And that's most it's probably the most sharply in focus with improvisation. That you say yes to everything that comes your way. It doesn't mean that you necessarily respond with yes. It just means that you're open to whatever's happening with your acting partners in an improv, and you accept the offer, and you can, instead of just ending the scene in some way, because you don't want to continue it because you're, you know, anxious or whatever. You accept it. And that's been something that took me a long time in life to really take to heart in a lot of other things besides just the profession. So, but it was a very valuable lesson. And ultimately, I did learn it. So,
yeah, I think flexibility is definitely important. Not only in acting. I mean, as you say, like in life, you have to have a certain amount of flexibility. You know, if someone offers you this job across the country, a lot of people would be inclined to say no.
Yeah. You might be anxious about moving. You might be, you don't want to leave a girlfriend or a boyfriend behind, you know, these various things come up and yeah, you have to get it right in your mind, and you have to weigh it all and be open about it. And quite possibly accept that as a part of a change in your life. Change is important. It's one of the things that scares the hell out of most people. It scared the hell out of me for a long time. It still does sometimes, but you work through it because change is inevitable. And change is, you know, as you go through life, that flexibility that we just talked about helps you adapt to that change. It's a really good thing. It works with a profession. It works with your relationships. It just tends to work that way. You got to deal with it anyway. Change is going to be happening to all.
I've been told a bunch of times. I mean, by different people, but mostly an old high school teacher that I had, and he said, "Change is the only certain thing." Because we live in a world of uncertainty, especially. I mean, now, especially. I mean, COVID was. It's crazy.
Yes.
The last two years have been absolutely insane. And the only certain thing so far has been change. I mean, everyone has had to adapt in some way or another, whether it's going online and doing work or doing school online or, you know, wearing masks even. There's so many things that have changed within days and within weeks that.
Yeah, within society too, you see the different areas of society and how they cope with that change, or whether they cope with that change. So you can really see it on a grand scale.
Right. I've got friends up in New York that I was talking to him. It was a couple of months ago now, and he said, "You know, if you went outside during," he came down to Florida for an air show. He said, "If you went outside during COVID up in New York, you're liable to have someone beat you up," because they took it very, very seriously. Yeah. And when he came down here to Florida, he said, "It's totally different.
It is different here. It is absolutely.
It was a culture shock for him."
I have connections and friends in New York because of both my career and some other people that I just have known for many, many years. And it's like, it was insanely locked down, especially during the first and second waves, but it's still they're not letting up because of, you know, obviously we've got the new one coming now. So but yeah, it's a different world down here. It's I think it has to do with population centers and where they're located and what the cultural traditions are here as opposed to up in the northeastern seaboard, which is a different mindset, and it goes back a long way, of course.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's also, I mean, kind of a northern thing as well, because I've got friends up in Michigan, and they're still, I mean, they're not as locked down as like New York City or New York or New England, but they're still. He'll call me and he's like, "Dude, no, we can't do this.
Yeah.
We can't do that."
And some of it has to do with urban versus rural too. I think there's there are different cultural touchstones in different areas, and people are very proud of their choices about where they live and where they've chosen to stay or go or whatnot. And sometimes that all gets wrapped up in sort of a decision-making process where maybe it shouldn't be in. You should look at strictly at what's happening rather than you know, cultural aspects of that, but culture is very strong. So it's hard to look past that. Very hard to look.
Yeah, you mentioned anxiety a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah.
Did you ever experience anxiety?
Oh my God. Yeah. One of the reasons why I drank and was self-medication for anxiety and depression, which runs in my family.
Okay.
I didn't know that at the time. Coming from a rural area, people don't get readily diagnosed with things, especially back in the day. But I've been suffering from it since I was a child. It turns out that once I got sober and decided to, you know, look into some analysis, self-analysis, and also with the help of psychologists, I started to discover things about why I was drinking, aside from the fact that my body really likes to be, you know, high, which is basic, but usually there's many other reasons attached to it. One of those reasons was definitely anxiety. And so when I refer to things like, boy, it took me a long time to realize that, you know, change is inevitable, blah, blah, blah. That was one of the reasons why I would fear that change. A little brief story. When I was first going to first grade, because we didn't have a kindergarten, so I didn't get a chance to get socialized in kindergarten before I went right into first grade. Yep, we're not going to do shapes and you know, colors. We're going to go right into numbers, you little bastards, you know. I mean, so I was scared. I was really afraid. And I cried on the back doorstep. My mother literally gently, but she literally kicked me off the back doorstep and had my older brother, who was in eighth grade, grab me by the hand and take me to school. Now, within 2 days, I was fine. But that first day, I had a real, I didn't, like a lot of kids, look forward to that first day in school. Not me. Mm-hmm. No unknown bullshit. No, don't want that, you know. And that was, looking back on it, that was a really seminal incident of how the anxiety was going to affect my life for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You got into drinking, and then after you kind of got out of it a little bit, and were you still experiencing anxiety?
Oh yes, absolutely. It's not like as a matter of fact, it got worse for a while because the alcohol is sort of tamping down all of those impulses. It's like self-medication, and so yeah, for a while, that's, you know, you have to deal with the things that you weren't dealing with when you were drinking, and that was one of the big things for me. So yeah, like I say, therapy, a variety of deep self-analysis, and talking to other people that experienced the same things, all of these things were very extremely helpful. And it's not like I still don't get anxious, but it's like how do you deal with it? Everybody gets stressed, you know, and so, you know, I approach it like that. Okay, is this positive stress? Is this healthy stress? Am I misinterpreting it? If it is, then I need to go with it. Or is this stress caused by a bad situation that I need to reassess? So you have to start really thinking about it. It's not like falling off a log. It's like you don't want to fall off the log. You want to stay on the log. It's the opposite, you know, of being easy. It's hard. But it's, you know, you learn coping skills. You learn to recognize how you're feeling and why you're feeling that way, what the situation is, and all of that sort of thing. And it's a day-to-day thing. But it's better than being drunk all the time. I got to tell you that. way better. When I first quit drinking, I went from 0 to 60 in terms of my ability to perform with my fellow actor on stage. I hadn't been performing drunk, but I'd been diminished because of my drinking, and I wasn't really connecting emotionally, and I wasn't as sharp as I should have been for a number of years. And I quit drinking almost 30 years ago. It was 1992, spring. Too, so it's been a long time. But at that point, I was doing a lot of acting. I was doing summer stock and some local regional theater, and they had cut back my workload the year before, and that was one of the things that made me realize, well, you know, I gotta get a handle on this thing. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I didn't have to hit a rock bottom, but I could see it coming. And so mm-hmm. you know, in the following spring. In 91, I was in two shows. I'd been in four shows for years. And it was only going to be in one show, but they plugged me into a smaller role in another show. And it worked out okay that year, but I could see it. You know, I was sitting around a lot and drinking a lot. And when I wasn't working or rehearsing and going, wait a minute, this is just, you know, this is why I'm not getting the work right now as much.
Mm-hmm.
Again, sort of assessing that, being at least somewhat honest with myself under the circumstances, was helpful. And so the next spring I quit, and then I was asked back. I told everybody, you make amends for the people that you messed around with too much or let down or disappointed. You do all the things that you're asked to do to sort of heal relationships, and it's really not easy. And it taught me a lot about pushing through anxiety at that point in time. Doing things you don't want to do causes anxiety. It just does, you know, and I'd always been sort of that kind of a person when I was drinking that would avoid that sort of thing. So I confronted it, and it took years really to sort of move back the other way, but it was a process that started almost immediately. So that was good.
That's awesome. Props to you. Yeah. That's,
well, it was, you know, it's like an old mentor friend of mine said. He said, you know, I'm glad that this makes you feel better. And I'm also glad, he says, I'm also glad you took my advice. You don't take credit for cleaning up your own mess. And I just don't do that. I appreciate people that appreciate what I've done, especially people that have gone through it themselves or I can lend a hand to, which is something that I've done several times with other folks. But it's like I cleaned up my own mess. That's what happened.
Okay.
I quit drinking, I had the emotional maturity of a 16-year-old, because that's when I started drinking. So for about 12, 14 months, I was like completely insane. I was a raw nerve, and I was trying to figure out where I was going to go. Not drinking, and I also quit smoking at the same time, so I was completely insane for a while. I mean, it was just nuts. But I did, you know, I sorted it out and started on a process. So I'd basically delayed a lot of my, even though I'd learned a lot in those years, and I had honed my professional craft and managed to accomplish certain things, I was still developmentally, I was behind emotionally a lot of people that hadn't gone through that. But I caught up pretty quick. I was pretty happy with that. So once I made up my mind to do it, things started to fall into place pretty well. But no, the anxiety never goes away, to answer your initial question.
As far as public speaking, did you experience anxiety with public speaking with acting?
Oh yeah. Well, for me, public speaking and acting are sort of twins of the same mother, because they both involve a lot of preparation. They involve an audience in front of which you do a kind of level of performance. And it's different. Of course, it's a different level of performance with each one of them. As a public speaker, it's actually can be more harrowing and more anxiety provoking because it's a version of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're not hiding behind any character. There's no mask to you know, safely put yourself behind. Mm-hmm. When you're on stage, it can be anxiety provoking. And when I was first in the professional theater, I experienced panic attacks and so on. And I think I've told you all this about this in class as a sort of an object lesson about anxiety when we were talking about chapter 3, which was about dealing with that. But that I had really bad anxiety attacks, and I had to take it on faith that I was going to be okay, that I wasn't going to have a giant heart attack at the age of 23, 24 years old, that I was just experiencing this because this was a switch that had been flipped in me. I'd lost the genetic lottery when it came to this sort of thing. I hadn't won it, so I was going to have to deal with it, you know? And so I did. And, you know, you come up with all sorts of ways to figure out how to cope with it, you know, breathing exercises. Okay, I'm going to go over the first part of my scene or speech, depending on what it happened to be. And I'm going to make sure I know that cold so I can say it in my sleep and do it in my sleep. And then by the time that first scene is over, I'm going to take it on faith, having experienced it a couple of times already, that the anxiety will subside somewhat and I'll be able to continue on and be okay. Mm-hmm. That's how it works. I mean, it again, it's crazy making. After that first season that I was acting professionally, and that was only in one or two shows because the rest of the time I was building sets and doing, you know, other stuff for this small summer stock theater, Acadia Repertory Theater in Solmesville, Maine, which is about 8 miles from Bar Harbor.
Okay.
The famous Bar Harbor. Yeah, it's right on the same island. So after that first season, it got better. And I discovered that I couldn't make friends with caffeine anymore. I couldn't drink coffee or do any of that sort of thing to stay awake, you know, working on sets. I had to do sugar instead. So chocolate became my best friend, you know. And of course, sugar is only one molecule away from being alcohol too. Mm-hmm. The molecular structure is only one molecule's difference. So they tell you in various programs that you go through as a recovering alcoholic that you'll probably want to eat a lot of sugar now. and we recommend that you be careful, you know, that you don't gain 400 pounds doing it, mm-hmm. and that you don't get diabetic or something. So, but yes, I still to this day just enjoy the hell out of chocolate. I have used sugar to give me a extra couple hours of boost when I was tired late at night or something, because I can't do caffeine anymore. Mm-hmm. It causes me to have a chemically induced anxiety attack. So I can't do it.
Sometimes I think that anxiety is also a motivator too.
Yes, it can. Absolutely. Adrenaline is, yeah, it can sharpen the senses and push you into places where you wouldn't normally go.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between like good anxiety and bad anxiety? Like, is there like something that you can like feel or say and you're like, whoa?
I would say that bad anxiety is that situation where the fight or flight response becomes so out of proportion to what's actually happening, where your body runs out of control. It thinks it's being attacked, and another form of that kind of anxiety is obsessive anxiety, where you obsess over something that's bothering you and it makes you anxious all the time. That's bad anxiety. That's a cycle that has to be broken. Mm-hmm. Really, because what it does is it keeps you from thinking logically about the problem. You know, what's the problem? How do I solve the problem? Instead of that, it's like, oh my God, 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 mm-hmm. you know. That's the same way with speeches. The kind of anxiety that motivates you is the kind that says, wow, this is the first time I've been in front of, or the second time or the third time, whatever, I've been in front of an audience. Oh my God, it's really kind of crazy making, but at the same time, I need to focus on why I'm doing this. I want a good grade, okay, if it's in a class, but also I'm communicating an idea. And this is one of the reasons why I allowed you guys to pick your own topics. I'm communicating an idea that means something to me. Mm-hmm. And I think it might be of value to other people. And one of the impulses that we have as human beings is to belong and to be of value to a community. Mm-hmm. I think anyway, most people do. Some people are like, you know, get away from me. But most people are like, let's do something meaningful. Mm-hmm. And that the feedback that you get from that often helps ameliorate the anxiety you may feel from stepping out there, mm-hmm. and taking a leap of faith. The tough part is when people have in memory bad experiences. Bad experiences can cause that bad anxiety to pop up at any time. Mm-hmm.
I think that goes hand in hand with, I mean, if you ask a bunch of people, what's your biggest fear? Like probably a large percentage of those people would say public speaking.
Well, it comes in some studies, they claim it came a close second to, you know, dying a horrible death. Mm-hmm. Literally, it was like that scary to a lot of people. And I get that. I totally get that. A lot of people, the sensation of adrenaline is extremely unpleasant. rather than invigorating. And that can add to the problem as well. I mean, I've had adrenaline shots before that were extremely unpleasant, where you get such a shot of adrenaline, your body freaks out. And after it goes away, your kidneys hurt.
Yep.
You know, it's like your back and your kidneys hurt because it's like, oh my God, I got to metabolize this crap in my system, and it hurts to metabolize it. Mm-hmm. And it's too much. So I understand having experience in any area always helps when it comes to being empathetic towards others' experience with it, and also maybe giving some guidance. Mm-hmm. It's always extremely helpful in that. So whatever you decide to do, please fully expect to be somebody's mentor at some point, you know, or help somebody else along, because I think that's a natural progression of, you know, civilized society. It's people working together in a community. Okay, I learned all of this and I'm pretty good at this, and now somebody else I see over here or wants to learn how to do it too, or is in that process that I used to be in. So I understand that. Mm-hmm. It's really important to have those kind of people in your life, when we talked earlier about mentors and having older people in our lives and more experienced people in our lives. All of that stuff's really important. And it's really important too to help you cope with things like anxiety. Yeah. Because everybody experiences it on one level or another. Mm-hmm. Everybody experiences what you refer to as the good anxiety and the bad anxiety. The good anxiety for me as an actor was that shot of adrenaline I get just before going on stage that didn't like make me feel like I was having a heart attack. It just sharpened every sense. And you walk on stage and you've got that. And it doesn't never, you know, now when I do that, it doesn't ever go into the realm of stage fright, like the so-called stage fright, the anxiety attacks. Does not do that anymore. It's a very real thing for many, many people, and it was for me too. So I can, you know, like I can empathize with people that go through that. Now, especially younger actors, because I was quite young when that happened to me.
Yeah, the mentorship aspect is a huge part of why I wanted to start this podcast in the first place. Because I mean, I've looked around at my friends, I've looked around at even people at the college, and I mean, there's a large percentage of people that really don't know what they want to do with their lives, or don't know what job they want, don't know what major they want, don't know what, I mean, they don't know what.
Yeah, that was the exact position I was in earlier in life. I mean, I had some things standing in my way at that point in my life, when I was 18, 19, 20, you know, in there. So what I ended up doing is I took a liberal arts education from community college. And I ended up doing all sorts of different things to decide what I didn't want to do. You know, I worked in the woods. I worked throwing drywall. I worked, you know, stuffing mailboxes with town reports. I did all sorts of weird jobs. I spent 8 months working for the Young Adult Conservation Corps in the early 1980s, doing trail crews and working in state parks. You know, it was really fairly heavy outdoor work, but it was a lot of fun. And it was, you know, I decided I didn't want to do it for a living. But it was something, it taught me a lot about, you know, what's valuable in relationships, working with people and being outdoors and so on. And it was not long after that that I ended up taking a job as an intern apprentice at a professional theater company, and did that for 2 summers. And that's where I got sort of locked in. That's been almost, that'll be 40 years ago. This next spring, I took that first theater job, and it didn't pay anything, by the way. Slave labor. But that's what you do in the theater. A lot of times you get an apprenticeship or an internship, and they teach you how to do all this stuff. And it was all technical theater for me originally. It was all lights and sound and sets and all of that sort of thing. Worked with some wonderful people. Susan Stroman was in the cast of one of our shows. She's a director choreographer now that's won like a zillion Tony Awards. But this was back in 1982, She was in a production in Chicago that we did, and she played one of the leads.
Okay.
And she was like 27 years old or something. She was young, and she was, she had, I remember, her hair was kind of reddish blonde. She had a lot of freckles, and her teeth were translucent. Mm-hmm. I remember that about her because I had never seen anybody quite like that before. I'd seen redheads that had some of those aspects, but not to the degree that she did. It was kind of interesting. That memory burned right into my brain. It was just, she was very nice. We didn't really talk a lot or anything like that because I was one of the plebs, but she was very nice to us. And I appreciated that. And I worked with several other people that were Broadway actors, Broadway caliber actors. And it's a small world. I ended up working with the wife of one of those guys 30 plus years later. She came to Winter Park to be in one of our shows. Mm. And Jan was married to Steven Berger, who was in Kinky Boots at the time on Broadway. And Steven was in a production of Chicago, that same production, Chicago. And he was in a number of other plays that season. Wonderful actor and a real cut up. I used to, I had a small role in a production of The Elephant Man where I was an orderly, walk on stage and change things around for the next scene, that kind of stuff. And Steven, although he had a couple of fairly good sized roles in the play, he was playing multiple roles. He was also helping out with one of these. And as we're walking on stage, he's going, "Hey, let's switch it up. You do mine and I'll do yours." And I said, "Fuck you." Away from me. Talk about anxiety, It's like, oh man. And I was not an actor at that time. So I was just, I wasn't having any of Steven, but later I appreciated his sense of humor. Mm-hmm. He was a nice guy. Still is a nice guy. Mm-hmm. Those kind of experiences. But before that, I bumped around a lot, and I think my parents were a little concerned, and they were taking the opinion of that your observation was, it's like, he doesn't know what he wants to do. What's he going to do? What's he going to, that kind of thing. And I did. I really didn't. I knew that I wanted to. I was curious, inherently curious about a lot of things. And I did have some problems with anxiety, and I did have some problems with alcohol that were developing at that time. But at the same time, it was a lot of curiosity. Mm-hmm. Well, can I do this? Can I do that? Can I do that? So in that respect, even though I didn't look at it that way, I was sort of embracing change in a way that I wasn't, that wasn't anxious or anxiety provoking. Mm-hmm. To me. And so when I look back on that years later, I realized, hey, that's a way to do it. Just don't look at it like a freaking obstacle. Look at it with curiosity. If you can, if you can make yourself do that.
And that's important. There's probably a lot of skills that you've learned over your career. Probably a lot of application skills like public speaking or being able to work with people, being able to talk to people, being able to lead people. It's awesome that you're teaching students now those same skills.
Yeah, it wasn't part of the original plan, but it was something that I was prepared for.
Okay.
Yeah. It was I didn't start teaching until I taught private acting classes through my 30s, but that was in conjunction with a theater, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And they were kind of just little classes where you taught, 5 or 10 kids and you did your thing. It wasn't anything really on a structured, superstructured level. Mm-hmm. But when the first time I actually taught a class was when I was a grad student, I was a TA, a teaching assistant. And they made me the professor of record of a class of acting for non-majors. And I had, get this, small world again. I had 6 students in that class. They were all design or stage management students. One of those stage management students is now the stage manager at Winter Park Playhouse. Yeah. Yeah.
Small world. They're
small. And that was in 2004. Yeah.
That's funny.
That was my first experience as a formal teacher.
Mm-hmm. We moved down here last August. My dad retired from one of the major airlines because of COVID, and we moved down here. And I was not expecting anyone to know anything about Michigan. And the first guy I met knew exactly what town, or like knew exactly where the town we lived in was in Michigan. And I mean, it's a town with 1,000 people, maybe.
Yeah.
And I was, whoa, it's a really, really small world. There's so many people I run into that know someone that I know, or know someone that knows someone that knows someone that I know.
It is pretty incredible. It's weird because my I had a girlfriend down here for several years after I first moved down here. After my second wife and I split, that's another podcast. her family originally came from Wyandotte.
Okay.
Which I think is on the lake, if I'm not mistaken, or close by. I'm having fuzzy memories now. But anyway, yeah. So I mean, her family was from Michigan originally, and her mother grew up there.
Mm. There's a lot of Michiganders in Florida. It scares me.
Yep. There's a lot of people from the Northeast down here too. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of people from Chicago area down here. There's a couple of bars called Friendly Confines that are dedicated to the Chicago Cubs. seriously. I mean, they show all sport. It's a sports bar. So they have like 50,000 screens and they show all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I'm also a sports head. That's one of the things I do in my spare time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a lot of people from the colder climates that come down here, either in retirement or they come down here to just flee the cold weather.
I'm hoping that I don't get to that point. At some point, mm-hmm. I know that I probably will, because most people start to hate winter and hate the snow and everything, but like right now I'm like, oh, I want to be up there. I want to go skiing. I want to go snowmobiling. I want to be in the cold.
If you're into that stuff, I don't think you'll get sick of it. I don't really think you'll get sick of it. Mm-hmm. My dad has lived in Maine for all of his 94 years. He does not like the winter that much, but he endures it for the rest of the year. And, you know, he plays golf. He still plays golf, believe this or not, but he does. Usually it's like 9 holes and that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, he's older, but he's toughed it out there. And he was born in that area, grew up in that area, and he stayed there. And it worked out really well for him. And it worked out really well for me too, obviously. Mm-hmm. But my oldest brother moved 3 times. When he was first married, they moved to Manchester, New Hampshire, out of the Bangor area. And then within a couple of years, he was in the Dayton, Cincinnati area selling cars. Mm-hmm. This is after he got his degree in elementary education, believe it or not, and then ended up becoming like a really good car salesman. Mm. I think the psychology he learned in college was probably the key to his success in that endeavor. But he ended up moving to Las Vegas about 35 or so years ago.
Mm.
And raised his kids in Vegas. And, you know, completed his career there as a regional manager of a bunch of this big super mega dealership. And he ended up, interestingly enough, he ended up going back and getting a master's degree. And he ended up going into teaching other car managers and car dealerships how to more efficiently do their jobs.
Awesome.
So he did end up using his teaching degree. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, he just didn't use it in elementary education. So
mm-hmm. It's funny how I mean, pretty much every experience that we have, I mean, we learn something from it, hopefully.
Yes. Yep.
And eventually we end up using that. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's if you're open to it, there's a, like when we talked about change, there's a great diversity of experiences to be had, no matter what your plans happen to be. Mm-hmm. There's a great diversity of experiences to be had, I think. One of the things that I try to, drive home in my classes is that the idea of oral communication is not just to get a good grade in this class or because you have to have it, which most students have to have it in order to get their degree at Seminole State, but also to take it outside of the class, use it to be successful or to be a leader in your field. And that's the thing about teaching it that I enjoy most, is that it's a useful skill. Mm-hmm. if people want to use it. And sure, maybe only 5 people out of the whole class will end up going on and using it a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. Or maybe only 1 person in a class will do that, but that's still entirely worth it. Mm-hmm. You know, entirely worth it.
Right. The amount of influence that one person can have is absolutely insane. I mean, we see even like in history, like the circuit preachers and stuff, just one person.
Yes. Oh, yes.
I mean, thousands and tens of thousands of people were influenced. And that's just the one that came to my head. But tens of thousands of people were influenced right there by that one person.
Yeah. So I'd say the great examples of that in the early radio ages, Billy Sunday.
Yep.
He was a 10th preacher. He was also an ex-professional baseball player.
Yep.
He used to use, because he was a great athlete, he used to fill with the Spirit of God and then just walk across the tops of chairs. But of course, it was his physical ability. Whether you want to argue it was God-given or whether it was something that he just developed humanistically, you can argue either way. But he used it. And it helped him influence. He used any skill he had mm-hmm. to communicate what ideas he wanted to communicate. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and I think that it's important in life to kind of experience it. You go back to the Ferris Bueller thing during COVID. I found that some people weren't affected. You know, I had friends that did the same thing. You know, stayed in their house, played video games. Didn't do much.
Right.
But there was other people, and that what I found about me is I'm more of an experience centered person, and I felt like almost experience deprived, because just I
Absolutely.
Wasn't doing anything. I was sitting in the house
Absolutely.
And I was, you know, twiddling my thumbs and I'm sitting here bouncing off the walls like, what am I going to do today? What am I going to do today? What am I going to do today? What am I going to do today?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you ended up percolating on that, but eventually you came up with the idea of doing a podcast.
Right.
You know, it took you a while to come to that conclusion, but maybe, you know, the positive thing to take out of that, even though it's driving you crazy, it gave you time to think.
Right. The podcast, probably my flying. I sat at home and studied and studied and studied and studied until I passed all the tests and stuff. But I mean, just about everything that's in my life now down here in Florida is connected to sitting at home for 9 months because of COVID when Michigan was locked down.
Right.
And it completely changed. I think it changed my way of thinking. Because there are so many different things in Michigan that I could think of to do down here. I mean, I kind of focus on what I know that I can do and then better myself at doing it instead of doing all this different stuff and never getting good at one thing.
Right. Right. Yeah, sometimes it's good to focus and sharpen things in one area. It's not bad to have good experience in a bunch of different areas either. But, you know, there comes a time when you probably need to specialize a little bit more for whatever reason. So that's what I've done. I've specialized in 2 branches of my life. I'm a theatrician, and I'm also a teacher of communication and theater. So that's what ended up happening with me. You talked to me 40 years ago, and I would have never dreamed to have been in this position. I would have told you, nah, I'd go home, see you later. Because at that time, I was I'd only finished about a year and a half of college, and I was working, and I was just starting to get ready to go to work in the theater. And I had not yet, you know, sort of gotten over myself in terms of the things that I was putting in my own way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting though to look back and see that person. Mm-hmm. And you'll do the same thing. I mean, you probably already have. I mean, you can look back, you know, 5 or 10 years mm-hmm. and a different person there.
Yeah. So. Is there any advice that you would give someone looking into an acting degree or an acting career or a theater career or teaching or anything that you've experienced?
Okay. Let's start with acting. Well, with an acting career, you have to have resilience. You have to be willing to be to handle rejection, because you're not going to get every part you go out for. As a matter of fact, you're probably going to get, if you get 1 or 2 out of every 10 or 12, you're doing really well, wow. really well. So it's still a pound the pavement job. It's just with technology, it's a little bit easier in some respects, but in other ways, it's a new responsibility. You have to keep up with your contacts. You have to make new contacts all the time. You have to self-promote yourself. All of these sorts of things. They're great skills to have, mm-hmm. wonderful skills to have. But it's acting is tough. You have to love it.
Okay.
That's my biggest thing. And everybody, it would be a wonderful world if everybody loved what they did. But that's just not entirely true. We know that. Mm-hmm. But with acting, if you don't love it, you shouldn't be in it, because it's too damned hard to get work. It's wonderful when you get work, then you can actually, you know, but the work is only half the battle. The work itself is only half the battle. Getting the work is the other half of the battle. When people used to ask me also, when you say, how do you remember so many lines? That must be so hard. And I always tell them, it's 10% of the job. Yeah, it's hard to learn lines, but it's 10% of the job. Mm-hmm. Once you learn lines, then you have to start to figure out ways to occupy an actual character, work together with your fellow actors, and create and tell the story in the way that the author intended you to tell the story. And all of that is the harder part. That's the research part and the practice and the hard part.
Okay.
And it's the same thing. If you're going to be a teacher, expect that people aren't going to understand how much work it can be, because they only see you in the classroom, or they only see you in the meetings or whatever, or they see that you get, like, for elementary and high school teachers, they get the whole summer off, supposedly. You mm-hmm. know, they don't, but they get it off from teaching in the classroom, and so people think that's, you know, well, they don't work so hard, you know, it's that kind of thing. Teaching is a misunderstood profession today, because it's especially on that level, it's kind of been demonized by a certain segment of society. I'm not sure why. I think it has to do with some political aims, to be honest with you, but I'm not absolutely sure why people buy that, because teaching used to be one of the most respected professions. And it still is a fairly respected profession among, a certain segment of the population. But with access being what it is today, too, and you get a certain segment of the population that questions every move that you make when you're on that level, which is why I have to tell you, I prefer college, because there's a certain amount of there is a clause called academic freedom. And so you don't have parents breathing down your neck and things like that, which, you know, for teachers that really love to teach young children, I give all the kudos in the world, because it's one of the hardest jobs in the world. Very difficult job. Again, love your job or don't do it. For your own sake and for the sake of those around you, love your job or move on. Find that thing which you do love. And that doesn't mean that you're not going to have to put up with some BS. You are. Everybody puts up with BS in whatever job they're in, because there's certain things you have to do that you don't want to do, whether it's paperwork or whatever it happens to be. You're going to have to do some of those things, but you need to balance that with the part of that job that you really, really love. And make sure that it's worth it for you. And because if it's not worth it for you, it's not going to be worth it for the people around you either. It's very important, I think, to have a passion for what you do. Mm. I'm sad that it's not always possible for people to do that. But I think for those of us who have the privilege of a first world education and, you know, any amount of focus, and we feel like there's something that we really want to do. And that's a gift. Mm-hmm. It's a gift.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for the wisdom. I'm running out of time here. But awesome. Thank you so much for joining me. It's awesome to have you. It was a great conversation.
Absolutely, Ben. It's been my pleasure.
Awesome. Well, I'll see you around.
All righty. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode of the Too Many Notebooks podcast. We hope to see you join us in our upcoming episodes. Our upcoming episodes will be mobile all the way from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you. See you around.